Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Offering myself at Bhagwan's lotus feet, this is Karuna signing in from Prashanthi Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. Om Shri Sai Ram and welcome to Morning Glory on Thursday Live, coming to you in real time from the Radio Sai Studios, where the time right now is exactly 43 minutes past 9 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time. Dear listeners, I have an amazing episode of Morning Glory lined up for your inspiration and information, which is absolutely must not miss. I highly recommend it, as it's heartwarming to see how powerful the impact of Sai love and teachings is upon our next generation, and also how sincere they are to live up to his expectations and take his mission forward. I would even go on to say that today's episode of Morning Glory must be downloaded for the listening pleasure and inspiration of all Sai young adults everywhere. But first, let me thank you for joining us on this beautiful Thursday morning, October the 1st, 2015. The current weather conditions in Prashanthi Nilayam, India, overall, bright blue skies with occasional beautiful white clouds scattered here and there. Nighttime low temperature of 23, daytime 32 degrees Celsius. Current temperature outside the Radio Sai studios is a picture-perfect 24 degrees Celsius. Chance of rain are high later in the day. And we welcome every passing cloud that showers us with some H2O to hydrate our parks and keep the weather nice and pleasant around here. And serving our ashram and all its allied institutions across Prashanthi Nilayam and in Prashanthi Gram right now are the dedicated Sevadal volunteers from the Indian state of Bihar. Radio Sai salutes the selfless heroes, our dedicated and disciplined Sevadals from Bihar, who are currently serving not only our ashram, but also all the canteens, the hospitals, the schools, colleges, offices, airport, museum, stores, and much more in every possible role with such love and devotion for our Lord. Meanwhile, the morning aarti has just concluded in the Sai Kulwant Hall, and right now, every grain of sand in Prashanthi Nilayam, every wisp of air, and every leaf on the trees is pulsating with divine energy and in anticipation of the spiritual extravaganza that is all set to roll out in less than 2 weeks' time. Starting Tuesday, October the 13th, 2015, the festival of Navaratri begins and goes on till Friday, October 23rd, 2015. As per the Vedic tradition revived by Bhagwan Baba, the Veda Purusha Yagna will begin from the third day of the festival. The other highlights of the Navaratri festival include the Gram Seva, or the hands-on village outreach service by the students of Baba's university and schools. Every day here in Prashanthi Nilayam is special. For instance, in 3 days' time, that is on October the 4th, 2015, the Sri Satya Sai General Hospital will celebrate its 60th birthday. Hundreds of thousands of patients have received loving medical care, medicines and other services here. The total cost borne by these lakhs of patients over 6 decades adds up to a whopping zero, zilch, absolutely nothing, as the Sai healthcare model that Bhagwan has set up does not charge any fee to the patients. And very soon, we hope to share some more fantastic news with all of you regarding the constant growth spurts in the Sai healthcare system over the past few years. But today, I have lined up 2 really deeply moving interviews with 3 phenomenally talented and dedicated and Sai-centered young adults. One of them is from MIT Boston, an engineer, and the other 2 youngsters are musicians who are blazing new trails. So first, I would like for you to enjoy the interview with an outstanding young achiever from MIT Boston, USA, Miss Ishwarya Anantabothala, Today I will play part one of this Learning with Love conversation. And next week you can catch the second part, which is the conclusion of this interview, right here on Morning Glory, same place, same time. After this particular interview, I will also play for you my colleague Mr. Bishu Prushti's Tryst with Divinity interview with the violin prodigy and an outstanding ghatam player, Mr. Sai Rakshit, the violinist, and the ghatam prodigy, Mr. Sainath. Part 1 will air today on Morning Glory and Part 2 right here on Morning Glory next week. All in all, it's going to be a Sai-filled morning with some special Radio Sai audios in between to keep you connected to the sacred vibe of Prashanthi Nilayam all day long. Have a listen, please. But first, an important announcement, and the interview follows on the other side. Actually, first a musical interlude, and then you can enjoy the interview. Dear listeners, and welcome to our occasional series, Learning with Love. Today, we have with us an accomplished Sai young adult from the United States to share with us what she has learned from her association with Bhagwan Baba and his mission. Miss Aishwarya Ananthabotula grew up in New York, USA, in a Sai family that has followed Bhagwan for three generations. Aishwarya attended and completed the SSC program at the Flushing Sai Center in Queens, New York, subsequently completing the necessary training to become an SSC teacher as well. Aishwarya has participated in a number of dramas, presentations and workshops and was blessed with the opportunity to play violin in front of Bhagwan as part of the 2010 U.S. pilgrimage group. Aishwarya thoroughly enjoys music in any and all forms, including classical music, bhajans, and English compositions, and has sought to use music as a medium to connect to the Lord throughout her life. Aishwarya has been active with the Young Adult Sai Group of both New York and Boston, where many SSC graduates like herself have taken to heart Swami's empowering message of leadership and pragmatically applying his teachings in a very unique cultural context. Aishwarya has worked with Sai youth through workshops conducted at regional Sai retreats and youth conferences on topics such as staying Sai motivated, taking Swami with you, and handling college admissions with the Sai perspective. Aishwarya has recently earned her bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, in Boston, USA, and will be returning to pursue her master's in engineering this fall. Currently, she is in Prashanthi Nilayam to spend her summer of 2015 to practice some music under her teacher who now lives here. Sairam Aishwarya.
Sairam Aunty.
And very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I offer my most humble and my most sincere pranams at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan.
Well, welcome to Learning with Love. We are so looking forward to learning some good lessons that a 22-year young person can share with us because of your love for Swami. And I'm sure people who are young and people who are young at heart can benefit by your learning. So go ahead and tell us what you have learned and what are your lessons for life that have come about as a result of your association with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba.
Sure, Auntie. So I guess I'd like to begin by saying that each of us is extremely lucky. Everyone who's a part of the Sai organization, everyone who's ever been able to call themselves a child of Sai, has been able to set foot into the gates of Prashanthi Nilayam. who's ever been able to utter the word Sai Ram with devotion. Each of these individuals is so extremely fortunate to have been chosen by Swami to be a part of His organization, of His mission, in a way that maybe we don't understand or we weren't able to predict. But in this category, what I want to say, especially, a population that is lucky is the youth, people my age group. And the reason I say this is because of what Swami Himself has said. We, the youth, are the torchbearers of the Sai community. We are the ones responsible for hoisting His values on a flag and marching forward from one generation to the next generation, and also marching forward into the head-on into the chaos that is daily life, student life, a life of a young professional. But the thing that sort of pains me today is that so many youth, and you know, people in my own age group, people that I can relate to, for us, Swami is restricted to something very quantized, to a certain place, to a certain time, to a certain group of people. Swami belongs to the photos hanging on the wall. Swami belongs to a time where we do bhajans, or a time that we go to center, or if something goes really wrong, to 108 Gayatris. That's what Swami is. And to so many Sai youth in our generation, it seems that Swami is something of our parents' world, a world that is in the Sai center, a world that just comes to a conclusion. It seems that Sai is part of a world that comes to a conclusion after Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon, whenever bhajans and Sai Center ends. And that's a very different world. That's the Sai world. That's Swami's world. That's our parents' world. But the message that I'd love for all of the youth that are listening to this, for everyone to know, to embrace, to understand, is that Swami is very much a part of our own world. The world that we live in, that we work in, that we learn in. Swami is very much a part of that world too.
The struggles on the campus included.
Absolutely. And I'll hope to share as many examples from that phase of time in my life that I can. But I guess perhaps for a generation before, Swami was something very physical. Our parents, our grandparents, they had the opportunity to walk with Swami, talk with Swami, learn with Him, be with Him. And it's almost the sweetness of those nectarine memories that give them the strength to go from day to day, to go forward. But for us, I'd love to remind the youth that Swami is so much more than His physical being. He's told us so many times, Swami is His word, Swami is His path, Swami is the life that He lived and the life that He expects us to live. So, in our busy, as you mentioned, our student lives, our professional lives, work, whatever it may be, it's so easy to make this distinction. There are two worlds. Sai world and our world.
How does one integrate them?
Exactly. They're two, we love to make, or we're used to making it seem as though they're two unconnected hemispheres.
Like compartmental.
Right. But how do we integrate them? How do we bring them together? Because they are very much one world. Swami lives in our world, whatever context that may mean to each individual. And it's just a matter of finding Him in that world. That's why the talk or the topic of this discussion is finding Swami in our world. What that means to each individual person. And hopefully I can share a few insights from my own experiences as a youth that maybe provides, shed some light on this.
Sure, please do.
So, as I was saying, Swami is very much a part of this world, part of our world. And all we have to work on, all we have to do is remember to find Him there. There's, in fact, a beautiful bhajan that was a little like this. Kahan main dhoondun Sai Bhagwan, darshan do, darshan do, darshan do, kahan main dhoondun Sai Bhagwan.
Very melodious. Obviously, you learn music.
Yes, music is very much a part of my life.
And you have a wonderful guru?
I do.
Mrs. Indu Dinakar?
Mrs. Indu Dinakar. And
yes.
It's actually because of her she's given me the inspiration to come and share a few of these thoughts.
Yeah. And this bhajan, it says, where shall I look for you, dear Lord? Give me a vision. Grant me a vision.
Exactly. I thought it was very relevant because it's, Swami, where do I find you? How do I look for you? I know you're there, here, everywhere, and you are present in my world. But where and how do I find you? So, quickly, I'd like to just take a few minutes maybe to talk about my journey to Sai. And I'd like to make a slight distinction here because I think this is relevant to people who might be listening. There's my journey to Sai, and then there's my real journey to Sai. So what do I mean by this? My journey to Sai on paper is very simple. I was born into a Sai family, a family that had held on to Swami's teachings and traditions for three generations. Began with grandparents on both sides, my maternal grandparents, my paternal grandparents, then their children, then us. And at that time in my life, finding Swami in the world around me was probably an incredibly easy task, literally and figuratively. Anywhere I looked, there's Swami's photos on the wall, Swami's picture on the desk, Swami's photo on the fridge. We had watches and necklaces with Swami's picture. Bhajans every Sunday at the Sai Center, every Thursday in our house, one Saturday a month in our house. Seva activities, dramas. This was the world that we grew up in. A house that just emanated with the teachings of Sai. And in fact, growing up, we used to have a joke that within the walls of our house, we used to find Satya, Dharma, Shanti, Prema, and Ananda within the walls of our house. My grandfather was Satya, always speaking the truth, no matter how blunt. Dharma was my father, always weighing the consequences of right and wrong and maintaining a disciplined household. My mother was Shanti, always maintaining peace, and hats off to her for doing it among such a chaotic household. And my grandmother, Prema, to everything she did, every word she said, infused with love. And people used to say that me and my younger sister, we were Ananda. Just blissful ignorance, the product of these four individuals that spoon-fed us Sai's teachings from day one. So, jokes apart, this was a lovely upbringing. And the reason I mention this is the fundamentals, the teachings that I got during this time of my life, maybe the first 18 years of my life, those gems would serve as my lifeline, the things that I would hold on to later in life.
You make it sound you really lived a long year, all of 22. So go ahead, tell us, what were these lifelines and when did they come to rescue you? We are just waiting to hear that.
Sure. And although what I'm about to talk about next seems like a very small portion of the entire time that I've, I guess, been alive, it was a very trying time, very different for me. And it's during that time that I'd like to share experiences. So speaking of this later in life, I turned 18 and I had to leave for college. First time in my life I was leaving home. And we've heard this so many times, but as Mother Kunti says so beautifully at the end of the Mahabharata, she asks Krishna, Lord, please give me troubles again and again, because it's during times of tests and challenges and troubles that we remember the Lord the most, that we think about calling out to the Lord. And trust me, going to college was probably the biggest challenge I had ever faced till this point in my life.
Why is that? Because I thought most young people in America so look forward to going to college, getting away from home, finding a pair of wings, just fly out of the nest and find your own place and freedom and friends, partying.
I agree. In fact, that's what I would have thought too. But when I left home for the first time, there were some things that struck me as missing. So I was away from home for the first time. No parents to help me make decisions or to make me food. And where I went to school, I went to a school called MIT. It's an engineering institute in the US.
Now, we've all heard of it in India. That's the aspirational destination of all engineering students.
Yeah.
Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
That's right.
Yes.
And growing up, it was a dream for me to be able to attend that school. And
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have to tell you, it has so many clones in India. So there is one very close to Puttaparthi, somewhere in Gorantala or Bukapattam or somewhere. It's called Gorantala MIT. So we use the term MIT. What it stands for is different.
Very different. But same idea, to be able to study there was a dream. And I still thank Swami every day. I don't know how I managed to get there, but that's a separate, I think, a digression. But Going to school at MIT, it's said that trying to gain an education from MIT is like attempting to take a drink of water from a fire hose. That's what it's like there. You're surrounded by competition, by ambition, by individuals that every single person is doing the very best that they can, but not everyone can get the first rank or not everyone can be a topper. That's just the way it is. And for the first time, I had to get used to a very different company. Company that came from all sorts of backgrounds, had all sorts of habits, and company that we had to interact with for academic reasons, for student organization groups, whatever it might be. So that was a shock. But one major thing that sort of surprised me is that SAIA activities, they won't automatically take place. My parents, my family isn't there to remind me that this is something that I should do each week to guide me. They might take place 20 minutes or 25 minutes away from where I'm seated, but amongst priorities of schoolwork, it's so hard to remember or to think about going there. And for me, this may seem like kind of a large abstraction, but going to college was much like a practical exam. SSE, Bal Vikas, the household that I grew up in, was very much the theory. I can recite to you the 5 human values. I can say all of the slokams that we learned growing up, Vedam. But going to college was as if all of the pillars of support were slowly removed from under me. And Swami said, I've given you 10 years or 18 years of tools and teachings. Come on, put them to the test. Put them to use. Show me. This is your practical exam. That's what college was like for me. So from that period of time, I'd like to pick up maybe a few subtopics as insights or experiences and share a few stories from this time that may be hopefully relevant to the youth that are listening to this talk. The first one that I'd like to talk about is, I titled it, Finding Swami in Our Activities. So what does it mean to find Swami in our activities, whatever those may be? Well, some things are obvious. Swami says, he talks so much about CIA. And in the U.S., if you say CIA, it's Central Intelligence Agency, and people will start getting nervous. But here I mean constant integrated awareness. So this is exactly what he means when I say Swami isn't restricted to a photo, to bhajans, to prayers. His teachings and his message is supposed to be integrated into everything that you do, every second of every day. But that's really hard. That's quite hard to think about and to practice. So there are some tools that we've been given. Make sure you pray before every meal. Make sure you can pray when you take a shower. Try to do namasmarana or listen to radio sai, listen to bhajans as you're coding or doing homework. Those with a bit of practice, those things can become second nature. And for those of us that have grown up in this world of technology, that's a great way to stay connected to Swami. But the question that I often get when I'm talking to other youth or we're having a discussion at a satsang is, what's the activity that you're engaged in? Seems like it has nothing to do with Swami at all. What if it seems like there's no scope to be thinking about Swami, or the objective of the activity is somewhat orthogonal to Swami's line? What do you do then? So even in this context, I might argue, I might suggest, even in such activities, there's scope to find Swami. There's a way to bring him into that activity. There's a way to address that activity to him. And you might have to be creative about it. But Swami cares about your effort and your intention. And if that's all that you offer to him, then he's there. He's ready to be a part of that activity as well.
Give me an example.
Absolutely. I realize this is somewhat abstract. So I'd like to share a kind of funny story. As you had mentioned, I'm very interested in music. Always loved to sing, play instruments. When I joined the university, there was a classical music group, but it wasn't particularly active. So I decided to join a light music group. And I really enjoyed that group, at least for the first several years, because everyone's intent in that group was not to worry about the source of the music or the intent with which the author wrote the lyrics, but to create pure, innovative music that was really a magical sound. That's everybody's goal in that. So one day we were having a rehearsal for this group, and often we perform in such a way where part of the group is singing the background, and there's a few individuals that stand forward and sing the solo. And I was leading the solo one day. We had a rehearsal for a program coming up in a few days. After the rehearsal, me and another student in the group, we were talking, and she's also a Sai devotee, somebody I had known before I had come to college. And she said, usually, you know, when you sing bhajans, when you sing Carnatic music, you sing with so much feeling, you can almost bring the crowd into what you're singing. Today you got up on stage, your notes were correct, talam was correct, shruti was correct, but it was really lifeless. You have to change this when you go for the program.
What were you singing? What language?
It was in Hindi.
Hindi, okay. In MIT.
At MIT. Mm-hmm. And I said, she asked me, why is this? Where do I find the difference? Why is there a difference?
Bhava was missing.
And I said, exactly. Bhava is missing, and for an obvious reason. When I'm singing bhajans, when I'm singing Carnatic music, I have the luxury of singing to Swami, to feel like I'm singing for a higher being. And that gives me that sense of bhavam. So she looked at me and said, great, why don't you do that here? I just looked at her as if she had 10 heads. I said, you know the answer to that. Why do you think I can't sing this to Swami? There's an obvious reason. And what she said at that time stuck with me. It sticks with me even today. And I try to carry it forward in all of the activities that I end up taking part in. She said, the intent with which you sing is something that's only in your head. The audience, the people in the background, the person that composed the song, they might all have another intent in their mind of what that song is supposed to mean or what feeling it's supposed to evoke. That's not your business. You sing with a certain feeling in your heart. If you can relate those words to Swami, sing to Swami. Even if you can't, imagine that Swami, know that Swami is sitting in the very first row, in the first chair. He's listening to you sing. And if you sing with faith and with confidence and putting forward your best effort, then Swami will love to listen to whatever you have to offer. So I tried this. I went on stage 2 days later, and I'll sing a few lines of what it was that I sang, maybe a slightly modified version that was playing in my head instead of what had to come out of my mouth. And I think it was relevant. It was just, the program was just a few days after Swami Samadhi Day, actually. Nahi samne, nahi samne, ye alag baat hai, nahi samne, ye alag baat hai, meri paas hai, meri paas hai, tu meri paas hai, mere saath hai, mere saath hai, Sai.
Very relevant words. You may not be before my eyes, but you're with me and you're around me.
Exactly. And just the thought of being able to sing that as if we were sitting in front of Swami and singing made a world of a difference, apparently, as I was told about that day's performance. Mm-hmm. So the point of the story is that no matter what activity that you're engaged in, going forward, I had to give many technical presentations, speeches about various things. Bring Swami into that activity, even if it seems like you shouldn't belong there.
What about a social activity after hours on the campus?
So a good way in which maybe to bring Swami into that activity is something I'll talk about later, is how to sort of guide your actions with Swami's teachings in that context. But imagine that Swami's there too. He's a part of that gathering. He's watching and helping you make decisions as to what to do in that context. If there's anything that may seem uncomfortable, just ask yourself quickly, with Swami, who's right here with me right now, would he be okay with me doing this? Would he be cool with me engaging in a certain action? And that's a simple way to bring Swami into all of your activities. So the next life lesson I guess I wanted to talk about was making Swami your activity. We had just talked about finding Swami in your activity. But what if I were to suggest that you can make the entirety of your activity that of Swami's? So I guess the easiest way to narrate this is through an example. There's so many times as we go about our daily lives that we want to engage in Swami's work. It's so easy to do that if you're doing Narayan Seva, if you're on a Gram Seva project, even if you're a doctor and you have the capacity to serve on a medical camp or volunteer here at Swami's institutions. But what if you're like me? You're an engineer. And that's the limit of the skill set that you have, is that you can build and design things. There's all sorts of projects where you can get on a plane and fly to Africa and work on building generators to create electricity, but my parents are not a huge fan of sending me to those things, obviously for my safety. So what can you do in the space that you live in, you work in? How can you make Swami your activity? So this was on my mind when one fall, one semester at MIT, I took a brilliant class. The class was called Principles and Practices of Assistive Technology. So the concept of the class was designing for individuals that have disabilities. How do you bring these individuals into the design process? How do you think about things like aesthetics, even things that matter to them? How do you understand their situation and use your own skills to create something that's useful for them? And I was absolutely touched by the message of this class, the way the class was conducted, and the idea that even the small population of people that face disabilities in the U.S., people may not realize that they're there or they could use some simple innovation, but if you take the time out of your lives to design for them, their gratitude is abound. I felt like this was a message that the other 1,200 engineers at MIT had to hear. There was 20 of us or 25 of us that took this class, and I went on to help teach the class, but that's it. There's a small population that can participate in it. So I decided, or I thought that there had to be something else we could do. So I got together with a group of two other students, and we organized at MIT what we call a hackathon. And a hackathon is where, for 24 hours or 48 hours, we paired together students based on some basic qualifications. Are you an engineer in some capacity? And individuals whom we called clients, people from all over the Boston area, where MIT is located, who volunteered their time to say, yes, I live with some disability, physical, emotional, cognitive, whatever it may be, and I'd love to participate in this activity where students will spend time with me and try to design something for me. And until this event completed, we were terrified. Would there be enough students that would show up? Would clients feel as though they're respected because they're volunteering their own time? Nobody's being compensated for this. It's completely voluntary. Will students feel as if it's too much, the burden to interact with these people? They're afraid to interact with people with various disabilities. I prayed and prayed that at least the event would complete safely and successfully. And Swami gave us more than we could have imagined. It turned out there were somewhere between 70 and 100 students that participated, 17 to 20 projects that were designed. It was an incredible event, and MIT was surprised that we were able to carry out such an event. The most touching part was interacting with these clients and these students afterwards in an exit survey and saying to the clients, how did you feel about the process? Did you enjoy it? Was it frightening? And the things they said touched us so much. They said they had never felt that included, that students would volunteer their time to apply the knowledge they had, to spend 2 days with them and try to design something for them, even if they didn't necessarily work or weren't at a stage of being commercializable. And the students had the same response, the same reaction. They said, we had never known that this was a space that we could apply engineering. Everyone wants jobs at Google and Facebook and Dropbox. This is where the student population is going. But to take the time to be able to apply our skills to something that's useful to other people, that's an incredible opportunity. And we hope you guys do this year after year. So the point of this whole story is that even in the space that you live in, that you work in, the knowledge that you deal with on a daily basis, you can find a way to make Swami your activity.
There doesn't need to be a banner that says Love All Serval or a photo of Swami hanging in the background. I'm not sure how well that would have gone at an event like that. But the event was carried out with the principles of Swami's teachings and founded on those foundations. And it made it so much more worthwhile.
Did anyone ever ask you what motivated you to get involved in it or to spearhead it?
Yeah, in fact, so many people, the personal assistants often of the individuals with disabilities or faculty that had come to judge prizes, they asked, you know, there's lucrative jobs out there for you guys. And assistive technology is actually a space that I'd like to go into for research and future endeavors. And they said, why are you interested in this? And the only answer I could honestly conjure was that it's so much more satisfying to know, to feel that my line of work is so much in line with Swami's teachings, that I can bring that world into this world and they can all be the same world. That isn't to say that if I'm a computer scientist or whatever other occupation I may have pursued, Swami can't be a part of that world. But this seemed like an easy path for me. It seemed like a way where the merging of the two roads were very apparent. So the next life lesson I guess I'd like to touch upon is called finding Sai time. So this might seem funny because I just spent so much time talking about CIA and how, you know, Swami's teaching should be a part of every second, every minute of every day. So why is she again saying, no, find separate time for Sai? Well, CIA and that sort of finding Swami in your activity, making Swami your activity, those are harder to do. It's harder to make that streamline into your daily activity. So that's why Swami has given us these institutions. He's given us SSC. He's given us a place where Sai devotees can come together and sing bhajans, engage in seva activities. But sometimes finding time to be a part of those is almost impossible or very difficult if you're a student or a young professional. And I think so many people who are listening to this can relate to that. And this was very much my situation at MIT. We had a lovely Sai Center. The Boston Sai Center is great, so active. They meet every Sunday. But the 3 or 4 hours that it would take for me to go there, participate in bhajans or satsang or YA activities, and then come back, was just time I felt like I couldn't spare or I couldn't find if Saturday and Sunday were the only time I would have to complete assignments. So I was feeling really terrible about this because this was almost a backbone of my high school activities. Every Sunday, I take time out to do this. So I had the thought, and Swami gives you an interesting answer. Not what you might expect, but an answer nevertheless. So one day I got an email from a friend. In fact, the same friend that had given this advice about singing in the music group. And it was just Swami's Samadhi Day or a day before, and I had gotten an email that said, "Hey, Sairam, I'm today really missing Swami's physical presence and I haven't had the opportunity to go to center in so long. Why don't we get together and do bhajans?" I was thrilled, but for two reasons. One, because she said, let's do bhajans. I hadn't done bhajans in so long and I love any form of music. But the second thing is the email said, why don't we all get together and do bhajans? So that implied that there were more people interested in this on the campus than just me and this other student who I had known. So I immediately went up to the two field in the email and looked at the other names. And there were two other male students who I had interacted with in various other activities, other Indian student organizations, whatever it may have been. But I had no idea that they also came from Sai families. So we were all, and they didn't know either about me. So we were all immediately excited and thrilled to be able to find the time to do this. But that in itself was a huge challenge. One of the most difficult things to do at MIT is finding a time that works for n number of people. So emails went back and forth after maybe 20 or 30 emails. We finally settled on a time. 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
2 a.m. That was the only time that seemed to work. Everyone had to come back from lab, finish other activities, finish assignments that were due the next morning. That was the time.
Just 1 hour before Brahma Muhurtam.
In fact, that was the only time. I first, talked to this other student and said, that's so weird. We do bhajans in the evenings. After that, we give prasadam for dinner or something. how can we do bhajans at 2 a.m.? We're all going to be tired. And she said, do you want it to happen or not? This is the only time that seems to have worked. Let's roll with it. Swami's blessing. Let's go. So we did it. 2 a.m. we met up in somebody's room in the dorm and prayed that we weren't disturbing the people around us. The bhajans that I heard that day were perhaps the most heartfelt bhajans I have ever heard. That isn't to say they were the most musically melodic or, you know, the most magnificent renderings of bhajans I have ever heard. But they were so heartfelt. Everyone was so grateful to find that company, to find that time to be able to sing before Swami. I remember one of the boys is a tabla player, but we had no tabla. So we started playing mridangam for bhajans. One of the girls is a harmonium player. We had no harmonium. So she started giving shrutis on an application on her cell phone. We had no kanjira, so I started playing on a notebook. These were our MIT midnight bhajans. And we continued it as much as we could until that group had graduated. But that's what I mean by finding Sahi time.
So you were four of you?
There were four of us that particular day. The numbers would change as we found more people or less people. But that's exactly what I mean by finding Sahi time. It might be in the strangest of ways or the most creative of fashions.
Where did you do it? In your dorm rooms? Where?
Yeah, it was in one of our dorm rooms, in one of the students' rooms. We just shut the door and hoped that we weren't disturbing our neighbors. We asked their permission. And we went ahead and sang for about an hour. Students are usually, unfortunately, awake that late into the night. So it worked out well. So finding Sahi time might come in all sorts of ways. It might mean you happen to have 15 minutes before your lunch hour or something that you can close your eyes for a few minutes. Or it's, you know, 10 minutes before you sleep, you can sit down with a copy of Professor Kasturi's Loving God and just sort of reminiscence or go back into the sweetness of those memories. Maybe that's your Sahi time. But whatever it is, and in whatever creative fashion it comes, you can find it. You can make time for it. So, Aunty, the next life lesson I'd like to touch upon is something that's really hard for me personally. And I'm sure also hard for so many people listening to this. And that is learning to trust in Him. Learning to place your trust in God. So, in times of difficulty, or times of trying times, whatever that might be for each individual, it's pretty easy to think of Swami, to think of Him. But it's quite another thing to be able to trust in Swami. So I'm using these words intentionally, thinking and trusting in Swami. So what's the difference? What do I mean? For example, you think of God when you get a pretty bad grade on an exam. In fact, you're probably pretty angry with God when that happens. But you trust in God when you realize that even this happened for a reason. It's a function of your effort, a function of maybe things you can't control. The class is graded on a curve. And you focus on what comes next, the next exam or the next set of things you need to learn. That's trust. You might think of God when you're walking home alone in the dark. And you're saying, Sairam, Sairam, I don't know who's going to come or what's going to happen next. You're probably thinking of God at that time. But you trust in God when you can visualize Him standing beside you, guiding you and leading you to wherever it is that you have to be. And in the same fashion, you might think of God when you're sitting before the altar and singing. I hope that we're thinking of God at that time. But you trust in God when you realize that He who is singing, He who is being sung to, and He who is the music itself in entirety is God. So this is really hard. It's easy to say all of this in abstraction and make all of these lovely analogies, but it's really hard to practice, right? At this time in our lives, thinking of Swami is simple. Swami, please, please, I need an A+ in physics. We can negotiate. I'll take a B- in algorithms if you give me an A in computer science. Thinking of Swami, very easy. Swami, my best friend got a top internship offer in Microsoft. Please, can I get a spot in Google? Please, please, Swami. Thinking of Swami. Even as simple as Swami, again in the dining hall today, they made brinjal curry. They made it just 2 days back. Please, Swami, fix this. Also thinking of Swami. But trusting Him is so much more and so much harder. We're basically taught from the time that we're infants or toddlers that life is about taking matters into your own hands, right? We have to compete with the world around us. We have to do better than everybody else, and it's completely up to us if we want to succeed. That's what we're shown, even if that's not what our parents tell us. That's what we're shown, the world around us, especially in a place like this. And suddenly, by the end of SSC, somebody says, yeah, forget about all of that. Place your trust in somebody else. Place your trust in God. So I had a terrible time reconciling these two messages. I had a tough time. And I love to say that MIT is probably the worst place for me to have begun this lesson on trust. So why do I say this? Everyone around me is talented. Everyone around you is achieving rapidly in spaces that you can't even imagine that people can be achieving in. Everyone around you has decided to permanently ignore the need for food and sleep and normal things that humans might need so that they can keep achieving. And so every day it's easy to feel like you're not good enough, that you're not as talented as the people around you, that you don't deserve a seat at the university. You can ask all the 1,200 students in my batch, and each of them would tell you that they didn't deserve a seat at the university.
Why? Why the sense of worthlessness? Because you keep comparing yourself to your peers?
Very much so. It's people, and one thing I was going to touch upon is that it's so difficult to feel at peace with what you can accomplish and who you are and what you can produce. Because it's so easy to just look across the fence and say that the grass is always greener. Mm-hmm. Even though it may not be. Everyone's putting in the best of their effort. And everyone is achieving in their own spaces.
That's sad. I wish people felt that, oh, they're part of something so magical and beautiful and high IQ and feel included. But I guess everybody judges themselves in silos.
Yeah. And I think that's really sad, as you had said, because there's, in fact, apart from the sentiment, there's so much creativity that happens in those walls, so much innovation.
Of course.
But when people look at themselves as individuals, they feel like they haven't contributed to it or something.
In an ideal world, they should have felt empowered to be part of this world.
Yes, in fact.
Yeah.
So that's honestly how I felt for the first 2 years of the time that I was at MIT. And I was wondering how long this would go on. You just feel very sad about yourself, very miserable. But, you know, no one's failing. No one's not producing. Everyone is doing the very best that they can. One day, someone shared with me a beautiful analogy from Swami. And I still keep the original quote of that pasted on my desktop, on my desk, or on my wall. And I'll give you a slightly paraphrased version. But it made the second half of MIT so much different, so much brighter. Swami says, you, the human, you stand on one side of a tapestry or a beautiful carpet, and all you see are loose threads, hanging threads, knots. You say, what a mess. What a mess this is. I don't know where these threads are coming from, where they're going, or what the bigger picture is. This is awful. But it's God who's standing on the other side of the carpet. He's the weaver. And he has the full picture. And God is saying, what a masterpiece I've created. I know what the entire picture is. And the analogy is very straightforward to our lives. We're local to only what we can do, to what we can achieve, and to do our best at that. But God has a vision of the bigger picture, of what is supposed to happen, and things that we may never experience or we may eventually experience. So what this person had told me was, just remember that you're a roll of thread in the weaver's hands. So you do your duty, just as the thread does. You follow the needle. You don't think about where the thread is coming from, or where it's going, or what it's supposed to form. It's meaning, don't look at the chemical engineer next to you and saying she's at the top of her batch, or the mechanical engineering and student, and say, you know, they're getting all sorts of recognition from the faculty. If you're doing your best, and you follow the needle, you do the thread, as the thread does. The masterpiece is in God's hands. At that point, you don't have to worry. So, like I said, trust is such a hard game. There's never immediate answers or results. But what is immediate, and what I'd love to share, is the sense of confidence the sense of satisfaction, and even to generalize and say a sense of peace. Because when you've placed your trust in the hands of Swami or God, you've also placed with Him your worry, your anxiety, your fear of the repercussions or the fruits of your actions. Right? The classic example is studying. You put in your effort and you leave the results. But I mean that even in a broader sense of going about your daily life and every activity that you engage in. If you do what you know you're supposed to do and you do your duty, leave out the fear, leave out the worry, the anxiety. Turn all of that into a more positive energy that will actually make your day brighter and better. It took me almost 2 years to think about this and to be able to practice it. And I guess the biggest example of trust is just having finished 4 years at MIT. I wasn't necessarily a topper. I wasn't necessarily on my way to becoming a Nobel laureate. And trust me, I have so many friends that are going in that direction. But I finished with a sense of confidence and satisfaction. And being able to be at peace with who I am and what I could produce. And the gratitude to Swami that He can take care of the rest of it. That's not my business.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory, coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, on the 1st of October, 2015. The time in the ashram right now is exactly 34 minutes past 10 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time, and you just heard part 1 of Learning with Love with Miss Aishwarya Anantabothra of the United States of America. We welcome your feedback to this interview with Aishwarya by email at listener@radiosci.org. And please don't forget to catch part 2 of this conversation right here on Morning Glory next Thursday. And now it's time to hear from two musical prodigies in conversation with Radio Sci's Mr. Bishu Prushti. Here then is part 1 of Tryst with Divinity with violinist Mr. Sai Rakshit and Ghatam player Mr. Sai Nath, both of whom are young adults devoted to Bhagwan Baba. Next week, you can catch the conclusion of this Tryst with Divinity interview right here on Morning Glory once again. As I leave you to enjoy this episode of Tryst with Divinity, I wish you a saisam awesome day ahead. Happy listening and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity, our series of conversations with people who have been touched by the love of Bhagwan Baba. I'm Team Radio Sai's Bishu, and today we have for you an interview with someone who has created ripples in the scene of South Indian classical music. Even though he's well known now for his talent and his passion for playing violin, the greatest thing about him is that his love for Bhagwan supersedes everything else in his life. Sai Rakshit from Chennai started playing violin when he was just 6 and gave his first concert when he was 9 years old, and since then he has won many awards. But according to him, his greatest moments of accomplishment have been those when he had the opportunity to play in front of Bhagwan. He is currently learning under the legendary Kalaimamani Kanyakumari Madam. Sai Rakshit had the chance to play during the birthday celebrations of Bhagwan in 2014. In fact, the 89th birthday celebrations began with his concert on November 17th. This conversation with him was recorded immediately after his performance in Sai Kovind Hall. In this episode of Tryst with Divinity, we are also going to listen to a conversation with Sai Nath, another prodigy from Chennai, who had the opportunity to play along with Sai Rakshit in Chennai during the Bal Vikas program by the children of Tamil Nadu in the year 2010. A master at playing the Ghatam, Sai Nath was again with Sai Rakshit during the 89th birthday celebrations of Bhagwan in Sai Kovind Hall. He goes on to share about his love for Bhagwan, about his passion for Ghatam and most importantly, his passionate devotion for Bhagwan. Sai Ram, Sai Rakshit, and a warm welcome to the studios of Radio Sai.
Sai Ram.
We just are coming from Sai Kuranthal after your thrilling performance, and I should tell you that it almost seemed like Bhagwan's students are performing. The students of Bhagwan's music college are performing, and this is
Swami's grace.
Such a beautiful curtain raiser for Bhagwan's 89th birthday celebrations. It begins with your concert, and in fact, one of your accompanists was from Bhagwan's music college, and you know, you could visualize seeing Bhagwan, you know, and enjoying everything that you are offering with so much love. So how did it feel for you? I mean, for us, it was really very, very beautiful, very moving experience. How was it for you?
Playing in front of Bhagwan is always the best experience one can ever get. It is indescribable. It is the best experience. You always have that. It doesn't matter who you are, but when whatever field you get into, you always want to do it in front of Bhagwan and get his blessings. And so it's not an experience that can be described with words. It's only.
And you are someone who had this chance to offer physically your music in the physical presence of Bhagwan so many times. And perhaps when you sit there, do those memories flood your mind?
Absolutely. And each time is a new experience as well. Every time you always experience Swami being with you and carrying you forward. It is Swami who does, who plays for you and does everything. We have no control over it. But anytime being in front of Swami and it's always the best experience one can ever get. It's nothing is better than that. It doesn't matter. And playing in front of the physical presence is something unimaginable. It's what everyone dreams about. And because of Swami's grace and daya, I was able to do it. So
you remember the first time you played in front of Bhagwan?
Yes. So it all started because of my uncle. His name is Ravi Shankar. So there's this group in Kanchipuram, Swami's group, who had this opportunity to perform in front of Swami, and they were looking for a violinist. Mm-hmm. And my uncle used to stay there, and he told them that I can play violin a bit. And Shyam Sundar, Swami's student, so he came to our house and he listened to me play, and that was how I got into this.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we used to have a practice, and we would practice for a long time, and every day we used to learn new things, because it was the experience. It was what everyone dreamed about. It was playing in front of Bhagwan. So we all worked really hard, and coming here, and the first time it was in 2008, and I didn't know the value of that too much, but my father is an ardent devotee of Swami, and he always used to say, this is the highest of levels, so do well, practice well. So I used to practice every day for that, and we came here, we performed, and it was the most blissful experience. So
you were 9 years old then?
Yeah, I was 9 years old. So
and you had the chance to offer your music to Bhagwan.
Yeah.
Amazing. It must have been really a life-defining moment. As you said, probably you didn't realize it then.
Yeah, but that is the inspiration that kept me motivated to learn more and more. Every time I take the violin, it's with the goal that I should play in front of Swami again. So that was the inspiring moment for me to keep learning and keep doing more practice to play in front of Swami again. That was the ultimate dream. And thanks to Shyam Ammana again, I was able to do it in 2009. With the same group, and that was the
Wow. So do you remember what you played the first time you you had the chance to offer your music to Bhagwan?
First time we all played as a group. So there was this Muruga song I still remember, Tiruchandur in Kadalorathil, which comes in Mohana Ragam. And there was this small little fillers I used to play. And for the second time, there was this song in Averi Ragam. So I was given this intro piece, which I was told to play by Shyamanna. And this was like a very challenging piece for me then. So I was so nervous when I was when we were about to play it with Swami. And the piece goes like this. It was...
Sure, yeah, please go ahead.
It used to go like this, and they'll start the song. Maname ganamum maravade jagadishan malarpadame. So this was the first piece I was... the first solo piece I was able to play to Swami. So this song I will never forget. And also that time we sang Muttai Thirubatthi Thirunagayatthi Thirushakti. And Yanta Manchiti Pu Swami's own composition.
Yeah. Oh yeah, play that. Amazing. And the Manchitipu, the sweetness of the Lord. And it is this sweetness that you always long for, right? And
yes.
He came back to Parthi again and again.
Yeah.
Every time. So what are your memories of the next opportunities? After 2008, I think practically every year you have come back to Bhagwan.
Yeah. Again, because of Swami's grace and His daya, I was able to come back again in 2009, as I told you. And in 2010, we performed a Tyagaraja Vaibhavam in front of Swami on 24th April 2010. And it was like a proper concert format with we were all 10, 11, and 12,
yeah,
I guess.
I remember all the artists were between 9 and 14 years.
Yeah, 9 and 14 years. And we presented a garland of Tyagaraja Kritis to Swami. And Swami first called us after the... He sang Jagadananda Karaka, Sai Vignesh. And after that, Swami called us and He gave us safaris. And then we were allowed to play two more. So we were allowed to perform two more songs. And Swami then asked us to sing a bhajan. So we performed Ishwaramba Priyatanaya and Ishwaramba Priyanandana. I'm sorry. Yeah. So and after that, Swami called us and he asked us our names and told us that He'll be calling us every year. Mm-hmm. And since then He has been doing so. So
wow, He told you He's going to call you every year.
Yeah, He'll be calling us, and He'll be calling us frequently. That is what He told us.
Wow.
And He told us that we should come and play every time. So
and He's been doing that, and He's been giving you those chances.
Exactly. Yeah.
Amazing. So after that, you came back. In fact, you came back once again that year.
Yeah, the same year. That was a Balavika's alumni program. So there was this. Actual slokas which was composed into different tunes by Sri Krishnamurti ji. So children from actually different states came. So
yes.
Sai brothers and sisters from Assam and I guess Delhi as well. So they all came for a convention.
Yes.
And there was also all the alumni students who all sang. Then Sai brothers from the north sang few things, and we performed a few slokas, Gajananam Buddha Gadadi Sevitam, it was all Ragamalika, and we performed this. Then Swami asked me to play, I was allowed to play Nagumomu Ganaleni, Aberi Ragam, in front of Swami. So I played that song, and Swami told me to play another song. He told, so I played the Vadan Sai Mata Pita Dina Bandhusaka in front of Swami. It is there. And then after that, the proceedings were over. They sang few bhajans. When a student went to Swami with the usual, he gave a rose to Swami, and Swami didn't give the rose back to him. He took the rose and he kept it. And the student came back, and the bhajans were going on, and during the aarti, Swami called me. So I went there, he gave me the rose, he patted me on the cheek.
Wow.
And he told me to take Pada Namaskar. So that was the most blissful experience ever that I've ever experienced.
Amazing. So that fragrance of his love is with you all the time.
Yeah.
In the form of that rose, he gave it to you.
Exactly.
And can you imagine now that was the last opportunity you had with Bhagwan?
No.
Or did you come again before Bhagwan's physical...
No, I was, unfortunately, I wasn't able to.
But now when you think about it, that was the last opportunity that you had with Bhagwan, and he gave you a rose.
So, it was unbelievable. I'm still in awe about it. So, because none of us, I wasn't expecting anything. I was just sitting there. We were sitting in like this circle, semicircle rather.
An arc.
Yeah, and I was the one closest to Swami, because I was sitting here, then the Mridangam was sitting, then the Ghatam was sitting, then the singers were sitting straight to Swami, then the lady singers.
Yes.
So I was the one closest to Swami. So I was just looking at Swami the whole time, and Swami called me, gave me this rose, and I didn't even realize what happened. Then only everything came into me. So
I know at that moment, you know, you stop thinking.
Yeah, you just go to the divine,
absolutely,
the ultimate, and
yes, I mean, you are so much in days and so much in now, and so much lost.
So lost
when you are in front of him.
So lost in his love. So.
Yes, and those are, I mean, but these are those eternal springs of love, you know, which will inspire you for your entire life.
Exactly, it will always.
Amazing. So you had the chance to play Sai Mata Pita.
Yes.
That was perhaps the last time you played in front of Bhagwan.
Swami's physical.
And isn't that so significant? You played Sai Mata Pita.
Yeah, I played it again today.
Adoring him as the mother and father and your friend and everything.
Yeah, he is everything.
He is everything, and you got the chance to express it through music the last time you had the chance to perform in front of him. Why don't you just play that?
Sure.
Was a Balvikas alumni meet, right?
Yes.
So you were a student of Balvikas?
Yes, I was.
From your childhood?
Yeah, my mom wanted me to join Balvikas, and I think 6 is the eligible age, yes, to enter. So as soon as I turned 6, the first thing my mom did was join me into Balavikas.
Wow.
And my mom was a Balavikas teacher as well. She was an Anantapur student.
Oh, okay. Your mother studied in Anantapur?
Yeah, my mother and her sister studied in Anantapur.
Wow.
So she also used to take Balavikas, and her student is taking Balavikas. So
amazing.
Yeah, so I started Balavikas when I was 6, from the beginning. And I just wrote my Group 3 exam and with Swami's Daya finished it.
Oh, you completed your course?
Yeah, completed my course just this year.
Wow. So in all these years of being in the Balavikas, what are your takeaways? What is it that you really liked about Balavikas?
First of all, it was the first time that I ever learned something with so much of fun and so much of interest, because at that age, when I was first put on, I was first put into vocal classes,
mm-hmm,
and I was not too interested in it because the gurus used to be a little strict and I had to learn, I had to practice. But this is the first class that I ever enjoyed going to.
Balavikas.
Balavikas was something that I really enjoyed going to because it was this value games that always added to it. So I used to anticipate and wait for Balavikas every week. It was on every Sunday at 10. So because of all the stories that the gurus used to tell us about Swami, and I was very interested in Swami's leelas because from my very young time, my dad and my mom used to tell me so many stories about Swami. So learning more about these stories, as well as learning bhajans and Vedas, as well as playing these games, so it was the all-in-one pack, I guess.
Wow. So it was fun time, and it was a time also to know more about Bhagwan's...
Yeah, it was fun learning. Fun. This was the only learning that I really wanted to... You know, if at that time, I was really not interested in school. I really, absolutely like any kid. So this was the only one class that I always wanted to go. And it started from there. And,
wow. And there was music also in Balavikas.
Yes, there was music. Because I used to play violin, and they used to, every Samiti anniversary, they used to give me this small slot to play violin.
Wow.
And that is where I guess I learned lots of bhajans, and I was the one who used to put jalra there because I used to really like doing that as well. So every anniversary I was allowed to play violin, and
the Samiti anniversary.
And yeah, that was the experience to look. And as well as we always had this Nirmor campaign, the Nirmor service.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what is this service?
Nirmor, buttermilk service, okay. Rather. Okay. So, we go out and we serve buttermilk to everyone who come. That too, this happens during April, and in Chennai, it's okay. hottest.
Yes.
So, whenever it's like really hot, we used to do this Nirmor service every Sunday. So they'll all come and we used to serve them more buttermilk. So that was something that I really look forward to.
You loved that service aspect.
Yeah, it was two things, the service aspect as well as drinking the Nirmor. So
yeah. Wow. So there were two, there are so many things that Balavikas really interested you. One thing was there was fun, and then there was music, and then there was seva. Wow. And I think that is the reason why you never left Balavikas.
No, I never left.
Fantastic. So, and as you're saying, you know, Balavikas also gave you this opportunity to play violin.
Yeah, those were the first opportunities that were given. And that was also another reason why I was able to come and play in Swami's presence.
Yes,
because they wanted someone in the Swami circle to play violin. So.
Wow. But when did this love for violin really start? I mean, you said that you were not very interested in vocal, but your parents put you into vocal. But when did you really feel that, no, violin is your call?
At first, I always liked music because my We have our house bhajans, and my dad sings really well. He also plays the harmonium. And my grandma always used to keep me occupied with music. So I was interested in music, but not to that level in vocal, because I was more intrigued in learning instruments. So the first time I played an instrument was a keyboard. There was a small keyboard in our house, and my dad was the one who taught me to play Janagana Manjanadi.
Oh, okay.
And
started with the national anthem.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, yeah.
Yeah, so
the usual things.
That is what I started with, and I wanted to learn keyboard as well. So, and when my dad asked few of his friends, they told it's better to put him into Western keyboard because it will be better. So, I entered Western keyboard, but my dad also wanted me to learn something Carnatic. So, he just asked me out of random, I don't know when this happened or how this happened. So, he just asked me, what instrument do you want to play? And I said violin, it seems, so...
You don't even know.
I don't even know why I said violin. Maybe I would have watched some concert or something. So, I was just intrigued into this instrument, so I just told violin. And the very next day itself, I think he took me to a class and he put me into it. My first guru, Shri T.V. Ramani, sir. He was T.V. Gopalakrishnan, sir's brother. So, he was my first guru. And my dad didn't know the procedures because there was no one who went to these classes. So, he didn't know the procedure of getting fruits for the guru and Vetala Pak for the guru, because you always offer that and then you start learning. So, he put me into this. Then the guru was just in the waiting lobby. So, my dad went in and he talked to the receptionist about this. This is like an academy, so he talked to the receptionist about it and told the receptionist that I want to learn violin. And she told my dad then that you have to buy all these before coming. But my guru, he was like, ippadala vandam, ni apuram vaingko, you just come and learn. So basically he told me to just come and learn. He just took me with both hands and started teaching me.
He had not even seen me.
He had never seen me. That was the first time he saw me. He just told me, come, I'll start teaching you. There's no need for these things.
No need of the rituals.
And he just took me with both hands and he has always guided me since.
Wow. So that was something, a blessing, right?
Yeah, that was a blessing.
Wholeheartedly accepting you even before you took the violin in your hand. And
yeah.
And then you had 2-3 years with him.
I learned with him for 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah, then unfortunately, there was some problems. He had some illness, so he had to be treated. And then the number of classes drastically reduced, unfortunately. So, my dad had... there was this friend in my school who plays violin. He learns from Kanyakumari Ma. So my dad saw him and told me, asked Kanyakumari Ma. And I played in front of I played in front of her, and she told me that she told me to learn under her student for a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Because to adapt to her style, because her style and the style that I learned was completely different.
Okay.
So I had to adapt to that style, and I'm still learning from Shri K.G. Rajesh, her student.
Okay.
So, I learned from him for 2 years, then she took me in, and
so
it's
when
been
did
good.
You become
in
a student
in
Kanyakumari-ma?
2009, and after the Swami program, she took me in.
Wow.
So, tall.
So, how has it been being a student of such a legendary artist?
The guru is the most important aspect for any art you're in. So, learning under such a legendary guru is unbelievable. It's something that everyone dreams of doing, and it's fantastic. I don't know what to...
I know you're looking for adjectives.
Yeah, so I was like, so she took me in, and she teaches for the sheer love of music. She doesn't charge anything. She just teaches for the love of music. So, but the only thing is, she expects us to practice a lot. So, getting into the class itself was like an inspiration first. And since I got into her tutelage, I had this inspiration to keep practicing more, because her older students, they all play so well. They are all in such a great level. So I always wanted to keep practicing, and she kept inspiring us. She always guided us in the right way. And the one thing that my guru always says is, you have to find your own style. She'll guide us to an extent, but it's after that we should find our own style and play according to it. So
discover, you know,
yeah,
go on discovering, go more.
Yeah, we have to keep discovering more.
Your own inner style.
She has been like my own mother. We all our students, we all call her Amma.
Yes.
Because she is always so close to us and she keeps guiding us.
Amazing.
So
amazing. And apart from her musical expertise, I mean, which is, as we all know, the world knows about it. But now that you live so closely with her and you interact with her at such a personal level, on a routine basis, are there certain facets of your personality that you probably didn't know and now you're aware, and your admiration for her has only grown over time?
She is always supporting of whatever you do. It doesn't matter. She always keeps encouraging you to learn more and support more. And she always tells me to go and play the bigger kacheris. The bigger kacheris in the sense, not the too small level, and listen to more and more kacheris. So
aim high.
Aim high. She always tells us to aim high. So I think the first time I joined her class, it was different because she expects us to play really well. She wants us to play really well and she wants us to keep going higher. So she used to, I used to find the class a bit strict, to be honest. So at first I was like really afraid of her, but then slowly keep learning and learning, I get to know that it's all, whatever she says is for the good. Just by just following her advice, you learn so much. It's even in whatever she says, it has so much of meaning into it. And if I'm able to play just a little bit because of Swami's grace and her tutelage.
Wow. Amazing. So perhaps the rigor in your sadhana has increased.
Yes, right? It has.
So how was it before and how is it now?
Before, violin just used to be, at first, when I was in like third standard or fourth standard, I used to hate studying. So violin used to be the escape route then. So there was this, my mom didn't want me to watch TV like every mom does. So she used to tell me to either study or play violin.
Okay.
So I was like, anything is better than studying. So I used to just play the violin and keep playing it. But after joining the tutelage of Kanyakumari Ma, it's like I daily, whatever I do, I keep listening to the greater artist, the Periyavas, who used to sing so well with, and with each time you listen to them, the same song, even if you keep listening, you learn, each time you learn something. It's like, yes, you miss something, but you never know. But yes, each time you listen to their songs, it is a new experience. So you keep learning that for every ragam, and then you try to reproduce it to the best you can. So it's more passionate now. It's more serious now.
Yes.
You want to
Correct.
Listen to them and you want to learn more and then play.
Yes. I think violin started off as a beautiful toy for you.
Yeah.
And but now it has become a very, very serious, and now I think it has now become your object of interest, your object of worship, your object of
everything. It is Swami.
Passion and devotion.
It is like Swami to me. So
yes. Amazing. Yes, passion and devotion.
The 90th year of Bhagwan Baba's divine advent is here. What are you planning to offer at his lotus feet? How about a gift wrapped in red? If you wish to partner with the Sai Healthcare to save a precious life, please take the time to donate blood at the Sri Sathya Sai Super Specialty Hospital whenever you are visiting Puttaparthi. The blood bank is open Monday through Saturday, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Every single day, patients undergo life-saving procedures here, and a pint of blood can make all the difference. Let's build a favorable blood inventory. If you're a healthy adult, please donate. For more information, please visit psg.sssihms.org.in. Blood, it's in you to give. Please donate. Sai Ram.
Ekonkar Satnam Karta Purak Nirpar Nirvair अकाल मूर्ख अर्जुनि सैभं गुरु प्रसाद जप आद सच जुगाद सच है भी सच नानक होसी भी सच चरण